This episode of Life and Books and Everything is brought to you by Crossway, publisher of the ESV Church History Study Bible, Voices from the Past, Wisdom for the Present. There are lots of study Bibles out there and a lot of good ones, and this is one of them, and it's unique. I'm not aware of another study Bible like this that tries to connect the dots with church history. There are over 20,000 study notes from over 300 of the church's most prominent figures throughout history, Athanasius, Chrysostom, Martin Luther, and more. So this is designed to help Christians of whatever age try to see how the scriptures that you're reading were understood or served as inspiration for or connected with the events of church history. So for all serious readers, students, teachers of God's Word, the ESV Church History Study Bible will highlight voices from the past, and it will, in so doing, offer wisdom for the present. I have a copy on my shelf and encourage you to get a copy of your own. You can go to crossway.org/churchhistorybible to learn how you can get 30% off with a free Crossway Plus account. We also want to thank our friends at Desiring God for supporting the podcast. DG has these great little micro events, courses, devotional opportunities, and there's one coming up for Easter, an 8-day journey through Holy Week from Palm Sunday through Easter. All of us as Christians are going to have our attention focused on those key events from the last week of Christ's life to his death and then his glorious resurrection. And you can receive a daily devotional to consider how Jesus saved the world in that one week. Of course, his whole life and ministry and his work after that, but we are right to focus on that in many ways as the most important week in the history of the world, or the week that changed the world. The website is desiringgod.org/holyweek, and you can sign up for this 8-day journey from Palm Sunday to Easter. Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Life and Books and Everything. Kevin DeYoung, pastor at Christ Covenant Church in Matthews, North Carolina, joined by the ever special guests, Justin Taylor and Colin Hansen. Because of scheduling difficulties earlier in the year, we were not able to do our usually start and end the season with the three amigos, but here we are midway through in March. Finally, good to see you. How are you brothers doing? Colin, you have a nice cough that we cut out before we power the menthols.
Colin sounds like he's got emphysema.
It might have something to do with the time change combined with fog, combined with I was just running, combined with our youngest son was throwing up all night. So somewhere between those four things, I may have woken up like I came from a Sioux City pool hall.
You're running.
Well, I mean, yesterday or last week on the treadmill, I was
sitting on the treadmill.
Like, oh, man.
Okay,
yeah, standing. Then I started to run. And
then I started to sit.
And then I started to fall. And I'm like, oh, man, I'm going, setting the speed at 6, and that's about all that I can do. And then the woman next to me was going 9.5, and I thought, oh, okay. I'm just never going to get there. That's
well,
not
the treadmill,
possible
you literally never get there.
That's true. You never get anywhere. But we've got a nice setup here at Samford. I can overlook the football field. I can see the mountains. Yeah, it's kind of motivating.
It is. I think this episode will air probably after this, but as we're recording it tomorrow, we have Doug Sweeney here at RTS to do our Harold O.J. Brown lectures. Looking forward to that. Do you run into Doug?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's just right down here. Doug is one of my favorite human beings ever. He was my first seminary professor. He's just one of the godliest, most thoughtful, kindest men you run into. Justin, you had studied with him at Trinity as well, right?
Yep. Yeah, I took a class on a seminar on Edwards from him, and yeah, a few people. So I feel very blessed that I took a seminar from Marsden and a seminar on Edwards and a seminar from Sweeney on Edwards. So probably two of the best people in the world to study under.
Yeah. Well, just a man of utmost evangelical integrity. Used both of those words very, very deliberately. So well chosen by
Yeah, I'm looking forward
RTS
to hearing
and
it.
just an honor. Yeah, just a great man to work with
I think
and
its
continue to
topic
learn from.
is something like
Love him.
the evangelical supernatural in early modern Europe. So, I don't know, maybe like
Okay.
fairies in Scotland or
Have you had anybody
no,
lecture on
nope,
that
we
before?
haven't had that. So I'm in fact, we've it's often been we did have Timothy George a few years ago, so maybe that was some church history things. But it's kind of Bible and theology. They're all very good. Colin, where is you said Doug is one of your favorite human beings. Where is Justin top five on that list, or where are we?
As long as I'm not in the car and he is driving, as long as that's the case, he definitely fits. Both of you comfortably within that
Within,
range,
yeah, good.
comfortably. As long
Thank
as,
you.
again, as long as I'm not in Justin's car.
My car automatically has a button that just goes to Casey's or Pizza Ranch, so those are
That's not the part I mind. If we,
okay.
if I could be assured that we would get there, I would
Justin,
feel
where
pretty
does
good
the
about
name
it.
Hy-Vee come from? Is it's hyphenated? Are those were those two people, or is I mean, it sounds like a rash.
It's probably everything's from Native American lore or something in Sioux Land, but
No way.
I have no idea.
All right, well,
Yeah. I
all right,
should
well,
look
there
it up
goes our
sometime.
sponsorship.
And write in if you know the answer to that trivia question from today's LVE. Where does Hy-Vee come from?
We don't know how to Google, apparently. Just because this episode is off to a wild start, Kevin, early modern Europe, that could include like the First Great Awakening, right? So he could be talking about first, I mean,
Yeah,
Edwards
that's true.
stuff
It
in there.
probably could. I think of it before that, but you're right,
His brother,
probably
Sarah Edwards,
before
or
the
something.
creation of America, which is, you know, where everything, you know, where the modern world begins.
Where
Started.
history started. Ron Swanson. Here you go. Sorry, I was giving Justin time to Google Hy-Vee, which he apparently did not avail himself of that time to Google about
I just
Hy-Vee.
ordered a
Anything?
what is this American history book? Freedom Just Around the Corner. Have you guys heard of by Walter McDougall? A New American History. This is several years old
No.
now, but 1585 to 1828. So that's an interesting time. But he's arguing the most important event of the last 400 years is the creation of America. All right. You want to co-sign on that? I mean,
USA.
that's not a Christian, you know, God's eye view of things, but
Well, do you guys think that people underestimate how radical the United States was in
I
its
do.
origins? I mean, as a political, yeah, tell us about that,
Yeah,
yeah.
I think because of the First Amendment, we forget that when we hear of these sorts of cases in parts of Europe, for example, that the UK does not have anything like the First Amendment. Now, the American
In
experiment
Canada
is
either.
certainly owing to all sorts of English traditions, and so there's going to be many similarities, but there's some key differences. But I think because of toleration and religious freedom, more or less in the Western world, even if countries don't have something as robust as the First Amendment, it is easy to think, yeah, this is just a, you know, kind of Whiggish view of history. This is just where everything was going. We were all finding our way there and not realize just how different this was. I've quoted before from Robert Dabney, and one of the reasons I quote from Dabney on this is because some of the people really like Robert Dabney. I don't think either know or would like this about Robert Dabney, but he very much says, to the charge that America is doing something with church state that had not been done before, he basically says, yep, we were, and we were Americans, and we got it right. I mean, that's my summary. But I think most of the 19th century Presbyterians looked back and were happy to say, yeah, this is an American way of doing things. And as much as we love the reformers, we think they got this church-state thing wrong. Now, that's not the everything that your question is about there, Colin, but I do think one doesn't have to be jingoistic to think that the American experiment is really unique, and it probably looks less so because it's devolved in some ways and because many others have done the same thing.
Yeah, it's been successful. I mean, I think we talk about this a lot because we all, of course, love history, and that's a big part of what we talk about on this podcast. But I think that Whiggish view that you described there is the enemy of interest in history. Let's just take a couple examples. Now, you brought up Dabney there. I would say it was more likely for most of the American Civil War that the Confederate cause would prevail than to think that the American cause would prevail through most of the mm-hmm. Revolutionary period. And that's just a random speculation that, I mean, there's no way to prove that one way or another. It's just to put it in sense of, if you thought the Confederate cause was doomed from the beginning and you thought that the American Revolution earlier was just obviously going to prevail, oh man, I don't know that doesn't seem to match the actual circumstances of how things played out. Maybe you have a certain kind of materialistic determinism that would suggest that, but
yeah.
I don't think
now,
so.
Now, that's
a
good thought experiment. And what we mean by this Whiggish view of history, this is the nomenclature used to describe a kind of historical interpretation that just sees everything was sort of just moving in natural movements of enlightenment to greater freedom and to where we are, and really taking out, as you said, really the contingencies of history. And I think that's what we forget in our own current moment. We can just think, yeah, there's just these inexorable forces, and we kind of know, whether in a very pessimistic way, it's easy to make the case that see how things have gotten worse over the past two generations on a number of different, especially social or moral or religious fronts, and think, well, that's just where it's going, or to assume, economically or otherwise, that things will just keep getting better and better. In both of those, yes, the inertia is strong. But there's contingency as humans experience right here in the moment. And that's true in the revolution. It was not at all certain. And I think, I mean, here's my question. Who do you put as the most, not the best, the most indispensable United States president? I mean, I think it has to be George Washington. I mean, and for all of his flaws, without someone like George Washington, you just don't have a country. I mean, I think that's really the case, that he stepped away from office, what he did in the army, even though in some ways he wasn't a great general, but he looked the part of a general and he gave confidence. Who do you guys put at the top of your list? Colin? Or go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, once you mention Washington, it's hard to be like, well, I think Reagan was better than
I think
Washington.
Martin Van Buren. So,
yeah. Yeah. Franklin Pierce is really underrated, I think.
Underrated in how terrible he was.
Yeah. That is one interesting thing once you study the presidents. It's like, we had some real clunkers. Like, you just kind of assume, like, these guys that look so stately and that they were just must have been the great man of their time. And like, no, they were, some of them were pretty cool.
Here's my Martin Van Buren factoid. You stumbled upon it. Okay. There's a couple of, because he's Dutch reformed Buren.
Van.
So not a great president, it seems, but he was the first president born in the United States. So the United States has the United States of America. And the only president so far to have grown up with a first language other than English. Dutch was his first language. English was his second language. So first American-born president and the only one to grow up with a first language other than English.
That's what
that is, Alanis Morissette. That should have made it in the song.
I thought... I thought this was going to be a reference to the Van Buren boys from Seinfeld. The gang. That's the only other popular reference I know to Van Buren. That Washington, though, guys, lends himself to a continuation of that theme of the contingency of history, because I suppose the Hamilton musical brings this back, but the sense of that he would lay down power, that he would not just become another monarch. Now, Kevin, you're the expert in this period, and I mean, I've read a little bit about this, and then of course there's a really big show of it in Hamilton, the famous line, "I didn't know that was something you could do," King George saying that about Washington. Was that an expectation? Was it a hope? How did that actually play out?
You guys would know Washington as well or better than I do. But I think it was two things in particular with Washington. I think, one, he had such a sense of honor and gravitas. And, you know, the criticism would be he was a monument even when he was alive. And he presented himself as a monument and looked the right way and spoke in the right way and kind of masked over all sorts of, you know, inner turmoil or mistakes that he made as a general. And yet, if you present yourself like that all the time, it is kind of really who you are. And so I think he felt very strongly this was the honorable thing to do, and had a sense of history that this had been done before, Cincinnatus. And then likely he didn't want to do it. I mean, we think of all the trappings of, you know, the White House now and what power it was, but this is a fledgling nation and it's difficult, and there's backbiting, and I think he didn't want, I mean, I don't think he was heartbroken to step back and do it.
The Capitol wasn't near his house yet either, right?
there definitely was. You see this in Jefferson, you see it in Witherspoon, you see it in Washington. There was this ideal, this 18th century enlightened ideal of the sort of savant, citizen, farmer, scientist, sort of who, that's why Witherspoon bought Tusculum, a mile outside of Princeton. He wanted to try his hand at scientific farming. I think there was this ideal. This was sort of the pinnacle of enlightened citizenry, bringing together all of your learning and being on an estate somewhere and trying your hand at husbandry and crops. And so I think he wanted to do that more. And who could blame him? Justin, you got any Washington tidbits for us? Did you read the Chernow biography?
I did, yeah. And yeah, I don't have anything to add necessarily, but I do think the point that you make about playing the part, and we've talked about this before, Kevin and I are both on the taller side of 6 feet, but you know, there is something about one's presentation, physical presentation. I mean, could Madison, with all of the same intellectual abilities, you know, what was he, 5'2"? I mean, could you have had that same?
Adam's short, yeah, too, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's something about that, about the he fit the bill and he presented well and sort of served as a symbolic picture of the ideal statesman and military man. And I mean, he really was not a perfect man by any means, but the perfect first president.
I just found cited this line from some Christian in America upon his death that referenced America as the land of Abraham, Isaac, and George Washington. So just put in, and you know, there's the famous apotheosis. Is that the right, you know, how you say the word, of the divinization of George Washington. And, you know, I've read a number of, you know, almost all of the churches, it seemed like, had some kind of day of a funeral, mourning, or celebration or something upon Washington's death. And they give a rundown of his life and the many ways that he was the father of the country. And, I mean, these are from good Orthodox Christians who are not divinizing him, but you could hardly be more congratulatory. You could be hardly more exultant in their praise. So when we have these debates about, you know, what did the founding generation of Christians want from the civil magistrate? And there's lots of things to say about that. But one of the simplest answers, we don't have to imagine who they thought was a civil magistrate that they wanted. And it was George Washington. They certainly thought, almost, you know, from top to bottom, they would have said, yep, that's the civil magistrate that we have been blessed with. And they, you know, they thought he honored the Christian faith. They thought he promoted virtue. They thought he was honorable. So I did not anticipate a George Washington detour, but...
Are we not slated, Kevin, for an America 250 deep dive into our favorite revolutionary
era? We'll do that at the end of the season. So we'll come to that later in the spring.
Okay.
But this is a good... What right. I did have first on my list, speaking of America, is the Olympics. I know they're the Winter Olympics. And a lot of jokes have been made over the years. It's fodder for comedians, and rightfully so. Curling is strange to us. Skiing and shooting things is strange. Justin, is it true you watched not a second of the Winter Olympics? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, there is something deeply wrong with me. I'm doing my quiet times were going on too long. I just didn't have time to watch meaningless competitions. No, I was aware of the curling scandal, and of course I've watched the replays of the hockey. But other than that, I'm afraid that I didn't tune in.
It just
too much. I'm sorry.
Nebraska basketball was just dominant. Is that what happened?
That's,
to
it's
you,
usually not worth watching through the season, but glued to the set.
Is this the year you guys win one game in the tournament?
That would be
disappointing at this point, though, if Nebraska only wins one game.
Right. We got to start by beating Michigan State on Friday, and then we'll go from there.
Do we play you on Friday?
Yeah. Is it the quadruple bye or whatever?
So that's already the quarterfinals.
The triple bye.
Surely we have to play somebody else, like UCLA or something, and we would meet in the semifinals.
Yeah, I think he's assuming. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, Colin, did you watch the Olympics?
Put in the show notes, Kevin.
Make sure everybody to watch. Yeah, I mean, I did not. The Winter Olympics came suddenly. I wasn't really anticipating them for a long period of time. I do think watching the Olympics makes a difference when you have smaller or younger kids in the home, because there's a lot of stuff that you can watch that's, you know, you don't have to worry about, and instill some good work ethic and love of country in them. And it's just amazing to me how all these young Gen Z people that I did not ever hear of before, I could all of a sudden just be going up and down with through everything. So, I mean, the Ilya Malinin's ice skating performance, we watched that live on a Friday afternoon, and it was just utter agony, and the honesty from him right afterwards saying, "I was just so nervous." It's amazing. And just thinking, it wouldn't have been this way if 4 years ago I could have had a chance first, but I didn't. And just to watch him have to process everything as a young man live. And there's something about that figure skating that is not... That lends itself toward nerves in a way that I'm not sure the bobsledders have quite the same experience. Maybe that could be, guys, why we're drawn to it. Because I love watching four-man bobsled, but there was absolutely no drama whatsoever. The Germans just have it completely figured out. Everybody who did everything they were supposed to do, nobody crashed. It kind of makes it more interesting if there's the possibility that somebody could crash in there. And I'm not saying that because I wanted to see people get hurt. It's just that when it's so professional, it's so perfect. It's like watching that Norwegian skier. Oh, wow, that guy is just of so much better than everybody else, and he can ski uphill.
He can run in skis, you know, under six minute mile.
I know. Unbelievable. So that's interesting to watch in a different way, but there's something about the human drama of watching him. And then, of course, the backstory of Alyssa Liu and the way that it was just the complete opposite. You could see that she was skating free. He was skating extremely uptight as the favorite. He's got to win it. Everybody knows this. He's got a huge nickname. There's so much riding on this. And he just collapses. And then she, of course, had been through that before and then bounces back and just, I mean, I'm not a huge figure skating fan, but watching her was just fun because it looked like she was having fun. Now, I have been a long-term Olympic hockey fan, and so bringing the NHL players back was awesome. Watching the Four Nations last year. Go ahead.
You look more like you played hockey than figure skating.
You might think that, but of course our town was too poor to do either. But that is a fair assumption. I mean, I had to come back and ask my wife, all these things that she did, can other people do that? Because I don't know how a human being does this. But I'm not sure what it was, but from the very beginning, probably because I just watched Miracle and I was really jazzed about this. But from the first bit, the first amazing goal from the USA, all the way to the last one, I was just, and had to tape delay, or, you know, delay it at home for church. I was blown away. But Kevin, I know you're big into the Summer Olympics. Do you watch the cross-country skiing or the biathlon?
I can watch almost anything in the Olympics, but it's hard to really sit down and watch that. I mean, I am a American-centric, or after that, Dutch-centric. So the Dutch, you know, very good at speed skating. Skiing, it's just hard to, I mean, Norway's so good at it. You're right, though, about the technical events in the, you know, Summer Olympics, gymnastics is sort of like that. Winter Olympics has a lot of those, and none more so than figure skating. You're right. You can, if you line up for a marathon, you might have a good day or a bad day or a race and you just didn't feel it and there was a surprise. But you just know you're going to do your best until you can't go anymore. And with these technical jumps, you just and I thought, cuz my wife did figure skating, I was, you know, she got third place at an event. Now, she is humble and be quick to say there were four people, but I want to say she got third place and she did a single toe loop or something. So she loves the figure skating. And so we've watched it for years. It seems like people, other than the quad god, that's his nickname, not a good nickname when you put god in there, whoever did that.
Or quad. Right, either way, it doesn't work.
It seems like people are falling less than they used. It seems like it used to be you'd watch the women's, and if you don't fall and you had a clean program, you're probably getting on the podium, but you just didn't see it. So, I mean, I my question for you guys, I mean, how patriotic do you get with the Olympics? I find unbidden the Jack Hughes goal, and then the interview afterward, and everything about it with his energy, and I love America, and the busted out tooth, and hockey, and I got lots of Canadian friends, so I'm not, you know, we can tease, I'm not interested in Canada's lame, or so. I instinctively feel welling up within me, wow, America's, go America. If you put on "I'm Proud to Be American," I sing this right now, unironically. Do you guys feel that? I'd like to think that's a good thing that wells up unbidden, not a bad thing. Do you feel that? Does everyone feel that?
Yeah, I think there's pride, and country can obviously go overboard like anything, but I think it's good. And I think if you're from Jamaica, you should feel that sort of national pride about Jamaicans. But there's not a lot of good, healthy ways to do it. Like, and there's very few events where you're like, okay, I'm going to get really excited about our economic prowess, or, you know, sometimes there's war, but that's obviously very serious and there's great destruction. So it's sort of an innocent way to express patriotic pride in your country that there's not a lot of great outlets. We have Fourth of July, where you can set off fireworks, but you're just kind of celebrating the idea of America. So to actually see competition, and it's fair. And at the end of the day, I watched the Miracle documentary too, which was really well done on Netflix. I mean, that provided great context for the hockey. And you're just at the end of the day, I remember Al Michaels saying he thought if they could even hold it close within the first period or
Yeah.
two, that would be miraculous. And there was almost no thought of America actually winning. But at the end of the day, you have to put the skates on and you have to play the game. And so there's a fairness, and to actually have victory, I think,
We play them
is a
ten
pretty fun
times.
thing.
They beat us nine times, but not tonight.
Well, isn't it? I mean, I agree with you so much about just it's an innocent way to be able to do this. I look forward to the World Cup. I'm not a huge soccer fan, but I love watching France and Germany go up against each other in soccer because it's so much better than watching them go up against each other in the trenches or in some other way. It's great. And I think, I mean, we don't have that antipathy toward Canada. It's different, of course, on their side. There is a lot more antipathy toward the United States right now for a lot of different reasons. And I think that had something to do with the intensity had to do with last year's fights, I think, as well. That was a big deal. And that did seem to be related to the Canadian fans booing the American national anthem. I think there's something about hockey as well, and it comes out so much in the 1980 story, and in that documentary, comes out really strong. Hockey, even though it's an expensive sport, it's a working class, middle America. Well, basically just
In
Minnesota
Boston
and
in the 1980,
Boston.
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, but still, the vast majority of American
Connor
hockey
Hellebuck's
players
from
come from a
Michigan,
pretty
so
small.
there, yeah.
Yeah, so there, and then and Hughes, I mean, Canadian background, but I mean in Florida. So yeah, there's some exceptions there for sure, but it's still very much a localized game. And I was just watching a bunch of highlights of Minnesota high school hockey, and they were fighting, and that was very foreign to think of. But I think part of it's just it tends to draw from a group of people who tend to be more overtly proud of being an American. And I just didn't I know I just didn't think it was about against Canada, but there is a certain sort of maybe it's not a great pride to say we could beat you even at your own
Yeah, the game
sport.
felt totally different than
But I
if we
don't
were
think, and we
playing
brought,
Finland.
yeah, exactly. That would have been, yeah, exactly. And I do wonder about this though, Kevin, because there's something to cheer for your country, but you really are cheering for humanity in the Olympics, and that comes out a little bit more in the other sports, the individual sports. Kevin, can you describe what's the difference between long distance running and cross country skiing when it comes to things like the emphasis on she's in the pain zone now? Just look, the kind of physical exertion and pain seemed in the
For the cross
extreme.
country skiing.
And I assume in cross country skiing, it seems like, I mean, I know that's kind of true, but can you describe
Oh,
any of
well,
the
yeah. I'm 48, so I enter the pain zone quickly. When I see that, I think I must not be racing hard enough. I just did a 10 miler a few weeks ago, which is a good distance. It's long enough, it feels like something, but you don't have to like train and train and train to do it. And I was tired and I was glad to stop. Certainly wasn't collapsing. Cross country skiing, which I've hardly done. I know running. I don't know cross country skiing, but it is, I think, of all the sports, the most cardiovascular. It's the most VO2 max dependent. It is just it obviously there's technique in it, but it is your cardiovascular heart and lungs engine. That's entirely what it is with every step. And I think that's why you see, I mean, they come to the line and it's just collapsing in a way that you see people do a marathon, which is longer. But I think,
Right.
yeah,
And they
you
don't do
can,
that.
you know, the professionals in a marathon are running insanely fast, under 5 minute miles, but they're probably not hitting the terrible pain until the last, you know, 6 miles or something. And even then, they can cross the line and look behind them sometimes. I mean, the LA Marathon yesterday, as we're recording this, I don't know if you guys saw that, but American came and sprinted ahead and won by less than a second. I mean, that's just crazy. And the other guy fell on his face. So it does happen in running, but cross-country skiing and the Norwegian guy, you know, all props to him, whose name I forget and probably couldn't pronounce. Yeah.
Norwegian guy.
We love you, Norwegian guy. Well done.
Yep.
All right. So now half hour in, from the sublime to the ridiculous, or the ridiculous to the sublime. I'm interested in, we've talked about this before, and I'm sure we'll come back to it again, but last week, again, as we're recording this, last week at Shepherd's Conference out at Grace Community Church, of course, John MacArthur has gone to glory, but they had some people that they hadn't had in recent years, and there was a panel with Mark Dever, Al Mohler, Ligon Duncan, was Phil Johnson leading that panel, and yeah, the optics of that were significant. I was glad to see it. I wonder what reflections you guys have on Young Restless Reform, the new Calvinism, the Reformed resurgence. I think we're in the front row for a number of things, not always, but some of it. And we could talk at length about what was good about it, what's misunderstood about it, and, you know, really, you know, honest and sometimes mistakes that should have been avoided but yet were made. But what do you see as the long-term fruit, and were you encouraged by that at the Shepherd's Conference, and what do you think is the future for this kind of movement or ism, or are we done even talking about it as an identifiable thing? Start with you, Colin, since you named the movement.
Okay. Well,
and none of us are young anymore. Council meeting, we all get just, that, yeah.
No, certainly not. Just had a council meeting for the Gospel Coalition last week, and Mark Vrogup, our mm-hmm. tall mm-hmm. Dutch president.
Taller than me.
Shout out, Kevin. He was just asked me to give a brief presentation of something that I've done before, which is looking back in celebration on the last 20 years. And we could all sit here and could and maybe should do an episode on all the ways that this movement is not that impressive or not that far-reaching or hasn't come close to its goals or has dissipated in different ways. But I really think, guys, it's very similar to the conversation that we just had about history. For some reason, it's easy to see things as inevitable, and it's easy to focus on the negatives. And then whatever's positive feels like it just, well, that just had to be. And so I go back and I think about the early conversations, Justin, that you and I had, and just hanging out over at Crossway there, right on the train tracks and getting flooded every year. And I look back and I think, who would have thought 25 years ago, the ESV and then the ESV Study Bible coming later, and to see the incredible expansion of publishing at Crossway. And so, I mean, I look at the Christian bestseller lists. I look at AI. And I just talked to a high school English teacher yesterday. That was discouraging to hear some of the things happening there with AI. But I thought, I'm just blown away by what's happening in Bible publishing and in book publishing right now. We could go on and on and on. And just to mention the churches, because you're mentioning Shepherd's Conference there, I just don't have a difficult time at all recommending churches to people all over the place. And it seems as though fewer Americans are in church, but it seems like at the same time, the kinds and quality of churches that people are in are actually better quite a bit. I'll just give you guys another example, and I'll stop and kick it to you guys for some other thoughts, because we could go on and on about the positives here. But another thing that I shared was going back over enrollment numbers at seminaries. And of course, this is a very sad thing to think about. You know, obviously, Justin, you having done some of your studies there and me getting my master's degree at Trinity, just watching Trinity move to Canada and shrink down is and sell off that campus to youth sports. That's really sad. And to think of just an absolutely amazing faculty over so many years, hard to imagine how we could have, I mean, evangelical world without them. And of course, Kevin, to your question about Young Restless Reformed, that was the place of the First Gospel Coalition Conference. That was where, you know, Don and Tim met, and that's where I had studied and where I published the book when I was a student there in 2008. And, you know, that wasn't the infamous ground zero of what I mentioned of Southern Seminary, but it was a hugely influential place. At the same time, we talk about seminary enrollments being so far down. But in the Young Restless Reformed movement, that is not the case. Over the last couple decades, enrollments at those affiliated or aligned or seminaries are stable. And stable in this environment is really significant there. So we could go on and on and on there, but I just keep going back looking at certain metrics. And I know we've talked about this before, but it's easier to get the wrong impression by looking at a few personalities or even looking at a few flameouts than it is to go back and say, there are so many things that are actually just going well way beyond what we would have thought back there in the day. So Justin, I'm wondering, I mean, you guys are in such a position of, you guys see so many different things at Crossway, and you work with just about everybody in some different way. So I wonder if you see it differently, or if you guys see momentum stalled or declining or infighting taking over. What do you guys see, Justin?
Yeah, I think the answer to that last question is yes. You know, is it declining? Yes. Is it thriving? Yes. Is there infighting? Yes. I mean, and I'm not trying to be coy by saying that, but multiple things can be true at one time. I think about Young, Restless, Reformed. We're no longer young, and we're no longer, I think, restless in the same way that there was kind of that angstiness and maybe a bit of immaturity, but also, you know, just a lot of ambition and energy. And I think it's matured into a more steady state, healthier thing, because I think you're right. The whole idea of the book Kevin wrote many years ago, co-wrote with Ted, on churchless Christianity, that's, mm-hmm. I just don't hear that as part of a discussion in our circles. Everybody you meet at every conference, Kevin's got Coram Deo coming up. Of course, that's geared towards pastors, but everybody at a conference, you wouldn't walk up to somebody and say, what church are you part of? And like, oh, I just, you know, watch online. Just, it seems like everybody you run into in our circles is connected to a church. And I think that's always healthy. I've been thinking a little bit about, you know, the generation that came before us, and this ties in with Kevin's question, and the number of men, pastors, theologians, leaders who are off the scene. Think about Packer first as kind of the oldest of that generation who lived well into his 90s. But then you've got MacArthur and Sproul going to be with the Lord in their 80s. Maybe Sproul wasn't quite 80. You got Howison, Keller. Carson is still with us, but no longer engaged in public ministry for health reasons. And so, you know, Piper at age 80 now is kind of at the top of that, kind of the oldest of that generation. And when a generation and leaders pass off the scene, you know, that I think that's an interesting place for a movement. And these guys that were on that panel with Phil Johnson, they're getting older. I think, Kevin, you might know the ages better, but I would think Mark Dever was probably the young man of the group at age 65. And so that's another generation down, perhaps, but you know, that they're approaching retirement age or slowing down. And so that leadership vacuum, I think, is an interesting question for the next generation. But I think one of my big observations is that we may not have the same sort of giants in the land, the superstars that everybody looks to, the guru, and it's become more diffuse. And I think you may not have the what Kevin has called the stadium speakers as much, but the number of Reformed evangelicals who have PhDs who can write really good books. I agree with you, Colin, and I'll make this the last word so I stop rambling, but I think publishing is a really bright spot in the evangelical Reformed world, that we have a lot more publishers. We have a lot of good books coming out. It's doing historical retrieval and republishing older works, but also new books addressing new topics. And I think the number of competent, clear, sane, wise voices is bigger than it's ever been. And you just, I've brought this up, I'm sure, on this podcast before, when J.I. Packer in the 1940s finds this set of Owens books, there were not any John Owen books in print. There were not any Puritan books in print. We are just in an extraordinarily blessed season of having so many resources, so many good things. It's just when Kevin and I were in seminary, you didn't have Bovink in English. You didn't have Turretin in English. Yeah. You know, the only way to access Turretin before that was if you read Latin and a high level of Latin. So we are just very blessed, and I think we have a whole generation now building off of those works. And so best of times, worst of times is always true, it seems like.
I want to do a quick bridge here, Justin, to Kevin. Building off the fragmentation comment that you made, some friends of mine were texting me this morning after Wes Huff had appeared on yet another massive podcast and said, and one of my friends asked, is anybody had a platform as big as this for the gospel? And I said, I mean, yeah, it's actually pretty small, unfortunately, with podcasting, present company included, compared to, say, what Billy Graham was able to do. And yet, still many reasons to give thanks for the opportunities and platforms that Wes has been given, or all the places that Jonathan Parnell, our friend, has been able to testify to the Lord's goodness through his church's difficulties in Minneapolis. There's just stuff like that that's happening all over the place. But then, Kevin, I wanted to kick this to you. I mentioned to the Gospel Coalition's Council a comment that John Piper had made to me at one of our council meetings back at Southern Seminary. We're about to walk into a session, and he was so excited, and he said, I just can't believe it. I probably shared this story with you guys and maybe even on this podcast before, but he said, when we started CBMW, we just didn't think this was still possible. There, all the momentum was on the feminist side to be able to see a gathering like this and to see complementarianism being assumed. You guys may have, well, you're aware of the review that Tom Schreiner just published with us against Preston Sprinkle's new book, and I think, Justin, you had shared about how Tom had mentioned 20-plus years ago, the difficulty for complementarianism is that we're just making the same arguments over and over again. Nothing's really changed, and yet it's like the arguments against are always new and novel and ever-changing. It becomes a little bit exhausting. But, Kevin, what I see is people still willing to fight those fights, those good fights, in defense of God's word and his teaching. So
yeah,
those are some of the positives. What
I have
seeing,
lots of
Kevin?
Thoughts. I'll try not to ramble. I think, you know, first, none of us have, even though you named it, Colin, I don't think any of us have any sense of defensiveness or, boy, this ism, have to come and defend it.
No.
You know, if we think of the movement as, you know, roughly spanning, you know, the lifetime of T4G, for example, which was the biggest conference, you know, and includes Gospel Coalition and includes publishers, includes blogs and all sorts of things. You know, I think we could fairly see some criticisms. One, you could say some men were elevated too soon. Some of those are just, yeah, you couldn't have known what someone would do. And then others, you think, yeah, that probably should have seen that person. But it's easy to see some of those in hindsight when in the moment someone seems to be trending in one direction and not in another. So that's a fair criticism. I think
We're also grateful, Kevin, for how those older men encouraged
well,
and gave
yeah,
us
I don't want to, you know, pat any of us on the back, ages. But that's to the point earlier,
no.
Colin, that it's easy to see the mistakes and assume the successes and just see, well, look at, we can list half a dozen, you know, men, Gen X in particular, who didn't make it in one way or another, and then forget about, oh, well, that person was given a platform, that person was given a chance, and that person is still doing good work. I think a second, you know, if not a criticism, at least an observation, I think there was from the beginning an inherent instability in the movement.
Oh, yeah.
You have people who are really coming from a strong confessional Dutch Reform, 1689, you know, Baptist, Presbyterian, and they're already, you know, historically grounded. And then you have Baptist evangelicals who are excited about Reform soteriology. And I think for the most part, most of them have stayed pretty much. And then you had the kind of young and restless part of it, that this was the new happening thing, you know, the famous, you know, top 10 things changing the world, the new Calvinism. And to some degree, the whole movement is now, its success is the reason for so much of its criticism. And I don't mean that you just have to assume that, you know, the criticism comes from people who are cynical or jealous, though that, you know, that happens in every human heart, and any of us can do it. But when Young Restless Reform is starting out, it's reacting against something. And there is something exciting to say, you see what we're coming. For a lot of people, it was coming from the attractional megachurch, seeker sensitive. This felt bankrupt and empty, or maybe it was coming out of the emergent and this doesn't have the theological backing, or just an A.
For all of us, Kevin,
yeah, or
it was the
or it's people coming,
right.
You know, the three
all
of us were on the main
here.
Line. So mm-hmm. You're coming out of something. Well, now, a generation later, it is the thing that many people were from. And so there's less of an energy in some ways, and there's bound to be energy on the folks who want to point out what the flaws are. And then I think that the third big thing is the rise of social media. Of course, the internet existed, and that's a big part of its success. And yet, yeah, any number of social political changes, we can say, well, that was navigated better than you remember, or you know what, that article, that wasn't our finest moment, or that was a mistake, or but then to be fair, you have to say, you know what institutions and what big tent movements have navigated this perfectly? None. I mean, the conservative movement, just not even the Christian, just the conservative movement, no. They've splintered, you know, into so many different organizations and trying to figure out what does it really mean to be a conservative. The same thing happens on the liberal progressive side. We're just not, you know, in that camp or as familiar with it. So all of these things have happened. And I think it, so those are, you know, maybe three areas you could fairly say, yep, those were some instability. Those were some mistakes. Those were some things not navigated well. And yet to the point that you guys are making, it's always easy to look back at the past. And you remember, and this is God's grace in some ways, you remember the successes of another generation. That is to say, you think, man, look at, you know, you could say, wasn't it great in the 18th century? The hymn writers, just one after another, all they wrote were great hymns. Well, that's because the ones that have lasted from the Wesleys or the Watts were great hymns. Yeah. And there are thousands that didn't last. And so we can say, if only, you know, we had, you know, the era of James Montgomery Boyce. You realize, well, there are actually hundreds of people doing what James Montgomery Boyce did. Yeah. And one of the reasons he stands out is because there weren't a lot of people. Or if they were doing it, they didn't have the reach and, you know, didn't have the internet to give everyone access to it. So it's easy to just see, you know, we're always asking the question, where are the giants in the land? And some of it is because when you look a generation or two behind, you can see who they were. And it's going to be harder to see in our own day. And with the rise of the internet, I mean, it's like the phenomenon of cable and then streaming. It's much more difficult to have, you know, you're not going to have Walter Cronkite, and just say, well, that's the news. And you got three networks. And so you're going to have smaller tribes, and it's going to be harder to bring them all together. And I think that's unique too. I've said this many times. There was something unique, and I think the Lord's blessing. It was a season where gospel coalition, together for the gospel, before that, alliance of confessing evangelists. It was a season of people from different streams coming together and saying, wow, I think we have a lot in common. That's not the season we're in right now. It's a season of resorting. It's a season of figuring out where the alliances are, admitting, so, okay, we didn't, that is a new issue. We didn't have to calculate, and now we do. But to the last thing I'll say, and you guys have made this point, you know, where, you know, almost any conference in our circles is going to celebrate expositional preaching. They're going to be clear about the gospel of justification, propitiation, the inerrancy of Scripture, complementarianism. We always need to keep fighting these things, and there's going to be people who are leaving on the edges. But you're going to hear people talk about the importance of the local church, and that gay marriage is not real marriage, and that abortion is sinful. And so it's not being Pollyanna-ish and saying there are no issues, or we don't have any, of course we do, but there are lots of strengths and amazing things that have gone on. And I say this to my brothers in the PCA, yeah, we got issues, and there's always people pushing at the edges. I think the PCA is, you know, slowly it's growing, so it's bigger than it's been before. It's more reformed. You talk to anyone who's been around for a long time in the PCA, they'll say it's more robustly confessional and reformed. I was just at our meeting with the Christian Nationalist Committee, Christian Nationalism Committee. I'm the moderator. I'm not on the committee, but I went to it. And yeah, as you can imagine, there are some voices in there that don't agree on everything. But I can say to every single person on that committee, those are really sharp guys who have really thought about this and really want to serve the church with it. And so I think there's lots of, just tons of strengths that we don't want to miss and overlook. End of three soliloquies. Anything you want to say before we wrap up with some books? All right, books. What have you guys been reading? What are you in the midst of since last we met? Start with you, Colin.
So, did you guys have to read Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451?
In school? Yes, so do my kids have to read it.
Okay. So, I loved my English experience at Chester Area High School, South Dakota, but this was not on our reading list. Did not make the cut. My wife was going back over it the other day, and she said, "Colin, you really do need to go back and see this." And we could not believe the way he anticipated the technological, the technology that he anticipated that is in our era. And this is a 1951 book. And so I reflected on it in my newsletter, just thinking about the significance of literacy, the power, the beauty, the wonder, and to not take it for granted. And I'm legitimately worried about literacy in an era of AI. I'm not trying to be panicked about it or anything. I'm not trying to overread the situation, but a lot of the arguments and a lot of what we're seeing with the adoption of these new technologies, especially from younger people, it's just very concerning. So for me, that's been a first principles book to go back to there as well. I don't think I've talked on this podcast, you guys tell me if I have, and we've talked about it a little bit ourselves, but Richard Carbardine's Righteous Strife, How Warring Religious Nationalists Forged Lincoln's Union. Either one of you guys read
it? Have it, started it, and skimmed it.
Not an easy book to read. I've just learned over the years the kind of history that I like. It zooms in on specifics, it zooms out on big picture. This is really a scholarly chronicle, effectively, of a bunch of things, like stringed together a lot of things that people said. But Kevin, I would be interested to know, we don't need to get a long thing on this, but you're really in the middle of this right now. I would love to know how the arguments about aspects of Christian nationalism differed
in the Civil War period versus in the Revolution period. I don't know if you thought about it at all. If you haven't, I would love to see you write about it or reflect on it at some point. And I don't know if that would shed it. You've already mentioned it earlier here in reference to Dabney. So I don't know if you've expanded on that, but that's why I did a deep dive. If I had ever done a PhD, it would have been on the churches and kind of the pre-Civil War.
Well, because it is quite different. Miles Smith, who I think we all know, at least know of, and I know Miles, and Miles is a friend. He's at Hillsdale, and his specialty is really 19th century. And I know he's doing some work right now on tracing that. And he wrote a book about, religion and republic, which I think was good on this. But the point you're making is true, that the founding era is about liberty, liberty, liberty. And the 19th century still has that love of liberty, but you have the Second Great Awakening. Of course, nobody thought of it really. It's something more disparate than that. But you have the country is becoming more evangelical in a lot of ways. And the sectional crisis, the coming Civil War, just Presbyterians, which I know for best, they start talking about slavery very differently in the South, by the middle part of the 1800s than they had before. And the conception of America and what can be taken for granted. So there are certainly differences, and even the scholarly debate on nationalism as an ism is debated. Most people say, well, maybe it wasn't until 1789 with France there's really a nationalism. Others think, but you see those same kinds of things later. But there's a German romantic kind of nationalism that is different. And that's always important to keep in mind. And I think James Wood has made this point, that the retrieval that takes place sometimes is, okay, you're going back to the magisterial reformers of the 16th and 17th century, but then you're wedding this with a kind of German romantic blood and soil nationalism of the 19th century, and those are not the same things.
Yeah. Well, it's just interesting that it's an important snapshot to look at the revolutionary period. But of course, the way that the South would have conceived of the Civil War would have been as a continuation of that revolution. And so interesting to look back and to see, like you said, Kevin, those theological changes. It's one reason why I teach on technological artifacts when I'm doing cultural apologetics, because clearly the wealth that slavery was able to generate after the cotton gin really changed the theological discourse there. Last book I wanted to mention, right up here, showing up here, Girls by Freya India. The Generation Z and the Commodification of Everything is going to be a big book when it releases in the United States in May. A lot of people know Freya from her write on After Babel for Jonathan Haidt's Substack. Just an excellent book. And what I thought was interesting, what we teach a lot at the Keller Center in terms of subversive fulfillment is a way of getting inside these secular narratives and be able to expose their weaknesses on their own merit before you make the appeal to Christ. It's been a long time since I've seen something as effective as this book at being able to do that with a lot of the particular challenges that Gen Z faces and is contributing themselves and a lot of what they've experienced. So it's going to be a big book, should get a lot of attention, and hopefully I'll be able to interview her sometime soon on my podcast.
Good. Let me run down a list of books, some old, some new. I'm looking forward, Lord willing, in the fall to begin a several-year Sunday school series on Christianity in America. So I'm doing lots of reading on that, which I've done before, but I reread Noel's book, History of Christianity in the United States and Canada. I'd read the first edition years ago. So that's just was fun to read. When I was at Princeton a few weeks ago, I went to the bookstore and I found one Banner of Truth book. They had David Calhoun's book on Princeton Seminary. So way to go, Banner, getting in there. But I picked up a book on the history of Princeton during the Revolution. So the battle there, but through the rest of the Revolutionary War. So that's catnip for me. Looking forward to just a couple of chapters into that. So I've been reading, yeah, lots of kind of founding era stuff. I had Matthew Spaulding on my podcast. So I just recommend his book again, The Making of the American Mind, The Story of the Declaration of Independence. I think if somebody's saying, just what book on the Declaration should I read? This would be a great one to do. I think he does a nice job. So he's a Hillsdale professor. Justin said that, recommended this to me, Emotion in Early Christianity. So it's a scholarly book on emotion, looking at that. Here's a book, really fascinating, Reform Forum published it. This is pretty niche, but Cornelius Van Til, Letters from America, A Dutch Reform Perspective on the Struggle for Orthodoxy in American Presbyterianism, 1935 to 1940. This is, he wrote a column back to the Netherlands, and he's commenting on, so he comments on Machen's death. He's commenting on what's going on in the Presbyterian Church. What struck me is he was very snarky. He wrote sarcastically about the liberals. And just reading, I think you say his name, Bujaszewski, is that right? His book, Pandemic of Insanity, which is, he's just such a good writer and used kind of, you know, apologetic, natural law sorts of arguments, or really, like you said, Colin, trying to get at the insanity of our age. But first, let me critique it from the inside out. And then a book I haven't read, but if there's any, in particular, any female listeners out there, I know this podcast skews very masculine, is basically the heart of the manosphere.
Masculine,
yes, and moms.
And moms.
So the moms, maybe. I got my wife for Christmas the Emma M. Lyon series. This is by Beth Brower. There are 8 volumes. She's writing more. And Emma M. Lyon, the Unselected Journals. So the whole series are journal entries, and it's sort of written in kind of 1800s Britain. But this is just a contemporary American author. And Trisha could not, I just didn't see her for a week while she read these 8 volumes. It's very, she said, I read some of the, it's very whimsical, clever writing. So it's sort of a take on this, eccentric, as I understand, heroine who's set back into Jane Austen kinds of predicaments. And every woman that I've known who's heard about it and read it just plows through all book and just keeps hitting refresh on Beth Brower's website to say, when are you coming out with the next installment of this series? So look it up, Emma M. Lyon.
She's on heroin?
A heroin.
Just kidding. Sorry.
Just like the billboards in South Dakota. Meth, we're on it.
Meth, we're on it. Guys, that just should have been a sign. Should have been a sign that the governor was not slated for bigger things.
All right,
go
Justin.
Ahead, Justin.
Yeah, at Kevin's recommendation, I'm listening to Pandemic of Lunacy 2, and I wrote down the subtitle, How to Think Clearly When Everyone Around You Seems Crazy. And yeah, Jay Bujaszewski is just one of the clear thinkers out there. Clear writer, witty, but very insightful. Knows how to use an economy of words. You guys will be proud of me for the 2 books I'm reading because I'm a latecomer to Robert Caro. I read his book on writing. Yeah. Or is it working? Which is masterful. If you listen to the audiobook, you can listen to it at 4 times speed because he's a very slow talker. I'm listening, switch back and forth, but listen to a good chunk of Power Broker and the first volume and Lyndon Johnson and... you guys are better, more prolific readers than I, so
I haven't read them all.
Colin's probably read them 3 or 4 times each, but
no, I'm only going back through the first one now. And when people tell you what the book is about, it doesn't actually sound very interesting. And then you read it and it's really interesting, which tells you a lot about the writer and the craft of the writer, his ability to be able to draw out important details and to be able to see what is important, and that just seems to be Caro's incredible gift.
It's not doesn't make for quick projects or quick listening or quick reading, but he just went on and on about what it was like in the hill country of Texas in the 1920s and 30s, without electricity to get out to the rural areas, and what the women had to go through. And, basically their bodies were broken down by the age of 40, because you can't take a day off. You can't take a sick day. The amount of physical exertion and what we assume of the wonders of electricity, that everything's at our fingertips. You can flip a light and do your wash and have the room illuminated, and so many things that we just totally take for granted. So those are two of them. Still plowing through Michael Burlingame's massive biography of Lincoln. There's the obligatory Lincoln mention in every LBE
Good.
episode. So those are a few. Oh, and I should mention Frank Thielman's Paul, Apostle
Oh,
of
good.
Grace. Big book. Every blurb, pretty much, Doug Moose is Thielman's book on Paul does for a new generation what F.F. Bruce's Paul, Apostle of Hearts Set Free, did for his day. So almost every blurb mentions the comparison to F.F. Bruce. But Frank is just such a good, clear writer, thinker. Of course, he's at Beeson there with Colin. So really glad to have somebody of his caliber and theology writing kind of the new go-to book on Paul's life
Great.
and ministry and chronology
I
and
did
that.
finish Watership Down, which I highly recommend. I mean, it's rabbits and it's 400 pages, but it builds momentum, and I got done. I thought there are so many good lessons and characters. My fiction book right now is The Odyssey. Of course, I had to read that or parts of it in high school, and I worked through some of it in Greek in college, but reading that in advance of the movie, which I hope they don't mess up too tremendously. Colin, what's your fiction book right now?
Fiction book right now. Actually, well, I just finished, it's not fiction, but it's Pat Conroy's memoir about playing basketball, but that really did shed a lot of light on his fiction. And I do want to say, shout out to all of our long-term LBE listeners, because for all of you, you got in early on the
Yeah,
Theo
for
of
real.
Golden train by listening to this podcast, currently the two times number one New York Times bestselling novel in America. So you guys got in years early on that. So
What a great
credit to the
story
LBE
of, and
listeners.
it doesn't always work this way,
Oh,
but of
unbelievable.
a
No.
very just an excellent work that people enjoy
Yep.
finding its way to success when it had no natural pathway toward that. Yeah.
No prospects.
And
That
like
man
the and
was in.
I've mentioned this quote before, and with regard to Theo of Golden, I think that C.S. Lewis, I don't have his quote in front of me, that it's very easy to write about evil, and it's very
Wow.
difficult to make virtue seem beautiful and attractive.
Good
And
point.
very few writers can do it, which is why every other movie, if you ever look with your wife, like, let's go to a movie. Oh, every movie is about horror. There are very
Damn.
few good resources on the beauty of virtue, and I think that's what Alan Levi was able to do, which I think there's a hunger for it, and people are attracted to, oh, this is what virtue looks like in action. And there's no smut, there's no sex, there's
Yeah.
no hardly any profanity. So kudos
That's
to
a
Alan.
where I can't remember where's that quote come from in Lewis. Do you remember?
I don't know, I'll
Yeah,
look on AI and find it
you can
for
find it in Hy-Vee. All right. Thank you,
you.
gentlemen, for joining us, and for our listeners, if you made it all the way to the end, congratulations. This has been Life and Books and Everything, a ministry of Clearly Reformed. You can look at clearlyreformed.org for lots of other episodes and thousands of other resources. And until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.